All right, folks, we're going to finish up with this last talk, saying that if it's okay with you, then when we meet this afternoon, it'll just be your concluding remarks, okay? We'll give that totally to that. By the way, Father Paul from Salt Lake gave me a quote yesterday that I want to read because, I, as you can tell, I like images that come from these patristic texts. He found a text from Elder Joseph the Hesychast, his Monastic Wisdom, sixth letter, talking about anger, what to do with anger when it comes up. And I love this quote and visualize it as I'm reading it. Therefore, when anger comes, close your mouth tightly and do not speak to him who curses, dishonors, reproaches, or bothers you in any way without reason. Now listen to this. Then this snake will writhe around in your heart, rise up through your throat, and since you don't give it a way out, will choke and suffocate. When this is repeated several times, it will diminish and cease entirely. But don't let the snake out. If you let it out, it causes more trouble. Just keep it until it dies. This is Elder Joseph the Hesychast, Monastic Wisdom, Sixth Letter. Is Father Paul here? Oh, he did. See, his 15 seconds of fame and he misses it. I just wanted to thank him for that. I thought that was an excellent quote. Okay, I just have a few concluding remarks to draw what we've done in these four sessions plus the introduction together. And I want to focus on the idea of evangelization in this angry age. How does that affect what we do in spreading the gospel, building our parishes, casting the net of the church farther and farther abroad? There's a problem here, because when anger begins to characterize that process, it can lead to all kinds of irregularities and dysfunctions. And I have a little story that I want to tell you. When I began teaching at Dickinson, I taught an introductory course in the Department of Religion called, very creatively, What is Religion? And as part of the paper assignments for that course, people had to attend a religious service of any tradition not their own. In other words, a tradition that they do not have a long exposure to. And they had to write a phenomenological analysis of what they saw, what they noted, the whole business. I had a couple of friends in my parish. They came to see me and they said, well, you know, Professor Pulcini, we're not religious at all. And we don't want to go to any religious service because it's just not what we're into. We're taking this course so I can really learn what religion is, so I can really oppose it all the more strongly. I said, well, that's your prerogative, but you do have to go somewhere. So they came across a poster. Now remember, Carlisle is South Central Pennsylvania, and the reverberations of the Bible Belt do pass into Pennsylvania. And there was a revival going on in town. And it's one of these revivals where people would meet in stadiums with bleachers and people would come, thousands of people come to these things. It's just amazing. And they said, can we go to this to fulfill this assignment? I said, yeah. I said, I always wonder what happens to those things. I don't have the guts to go myself, but you can tell me. And in your paper, you can use that as a basis of your analysis. All right, but here's what happened. They wrote an excellent paper, a very good, dispassionate kind of description and reflection on what they saw. And at the end of the reflection, they said this. It was the reflection at the end of the paper that included one of those stunning insights to which I just alluded. It read something like this. These people sitting all around me all seemed angry about something. Under all the talk about truth and love and righteousness and morality and compassion and faith, there was a current of anger that was always sweeping the people away. They were most enthusiastic, it seems to me, when they were angriest. The speakers knew that the surest way to get the people whipped up was to play on their anger. That is why I am not a religious person. Whenever I went to church or talked to committed Christians of whatever stripe, the anger was always there, and here's the phrase they used, like endless fuel. Like endless fuel powering the engine. I love that image and I wrote it down. I have to admit that student's description hit a nerve with me. And I want to play on this theme a little bit as I end my presentations here. We're constantly engaging in evangelization, and I think that what we have to do, to be honest, is to look at how anger might be somehow distorting that process. So I just want to make a few observations on that point, and we can discuss or make reactions to it. I came across an article recently, and it was on, I think, in Christianity Today, or one of the related periodicals. The Devil's Delight is Angry Religion, because it gives a basis for doing exactly what this student did, writing off religion as unhealthy because of the undercurrent of anger that's always running through it. This is something that I think we have to face because it even happens among ourselves. What do we mean by angry religion? Here's my definition of it. An angry religion encourages people to form an identity of what they're not on the basis of what they are. I call it apophatic identity formation. They can't tell you what makes them a Christian. They can't tell you what makes them a member of this denomination. But if you ask them what they are, they will tell you what they're against. And this kind of apophatic identity formation is a very, I think, anemic way of coming to a religious maturity. We can all say what we're not, but when we're really pushed to saying what we are and what motivates us in our belief, a lot of these people come up angry, and they come up empty because of the anger that is always there, forcing them not to form a more positive kind of religious identity. I see this a lot. In Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where Dickinson is, we just had, this is that world-famous piece of journalism, the Dickinsonian. And the headline recently was this: New Buddhist Temple Opens in Carlisle. All right? It opened to great fanfare, to a lot of support from students. And I will tell you, 90% of the students I talked to and a lot of the people from the community came from Christian backgrounds. And they are now members of this Buddhist community, which, by the way, is led by a very impressive teacher, a very good man. And when you talk to them, one of the things that comes up when you ask them, why is it that this really attracted you? And why don't you go back to the Lutheran church in which you were raised, or the Catholic church in which you were raised, or the Orthodox church in which you were raised? And the answer to them is, I always, when I go to the Buddhist temple, I find peace and a diminution of anger. When I go to these other churches, what I just described, what those students experience, they experience in some way. This kind of need to flee from anger is something that I don't think is totally fair in all cases, but it does point to a problem that we have in a lot of our evangelization techniques. How many of us have discovered the trick of a lot of these revivalist speakers? The angrier we can get people about something, the more we have them in the palm of our hand, and the more we can get them on board. Anger is sometimes justified against an unjust process or cause, but when it becomes the main fuel that fuels the engine, then it becomes a destructive force in religion. And evangelization has to avoid this tendency to want to get a quick result by playing on people's anger. If we do that, in many ways, we're just paralleling with religious garb what our political system is doing today. And this, as we see, is not a good thing. There are other ways to deal with problems that are real. I wanted to point that out because it leads to other things. This summer, when I was reading, you had in Time magazine three books that were reviewed in Time magazine. The date was, when it was October 15, 2018. And the title of the article, the review, is Mad as Hell, The Power of Woman's Rage in 2018. And what it does, this article, it talks about books that I haven't read any of these, but I'll give you the titles. Soraya Shemeli wrote a book, Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. Rebecca Traister wrote a book, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. And Gemma Hartley wrote a book, Fed Up, Emotional Labor, Women and the Way Forward, which focuses primarily on anger. In one article, these books are selling like crazy. Anger as a current in the political domain or in the countercultural or subcultural domain is beginning to infiltrate into the religious domain as well and being played upon for success in evangelization. But my argument is, I think ultimately this is going to backfire. So I read another book which is much more serious and much better aimed at this issue of anger. And that's Martha Nussbaum's book. Martha Nussbaum is a world-famous philosopher. I took my first Aristotle course with her way back in the 70s, and she wrote a book called The Monarchy of Fear. And in this book, The Monarchy of Fear, chapter 3 is entitled Anger, the Child of Fear. And she talks about how in Greece, she's a classicist. She never relates this specifically to contemporary political movements, but she looks at classical Greece and the transition that happened between a politics that was based on anger, where the Furies were seen as inflicting punishment upon those who opposed the system as it was, to a much more mature system of getting people to identify as part of the political scene and the political dialogue that was going on. She talks about this in the book, and she says you constantly have to separate between anger at unjust causes, which is valid, and what she calls retributive anger. Anger in our system where you're always aiming against someone and targeting people that you want to demonize, you want to mock, and somehow make them the counterpoint to your own identity. We do that in the religious world as well these days, and I think it's ultimately not a productive way to go. This anger, child of fear, is a very revealing chapter. And this book in general is not a, popular screed. It's a very measured scholarly work. But I think that what she says about anger as a political lever and a power tool in our culture is beginning to be something that we see more and more in religious circles, and something we have to look at. And so I want to leave you with this general question here. What is our role as Orthodox Christians and as clergy in overcoming what I see as a progressing societal scourge? What are all the temporary works focusing on your share is a perspective that is social scientific. What I mean by that, it's concerned with the collective manifestation of anger and the macro manipulations that can lead to a reconstruction of the collective. What do I mean by that? You read Martha Nussbaum, you read these three books about anger that I listed on the previous slide. It's all about anger as this social phenomenon, as a societal movement, as a political current, as a subcultural agenda. What's missing here is the personal dimension of it. It's so much easier to talk about social movements and political movements than it is to talk about individual personal transformation. I think that what we have to do is to show our culture that anger, if it's going to be overcome and controlled, is not going to be controlled by the mechanisms of society or of large groups. It has to be controlled by the reform of individuals. The individual transformation, a spiritual transformation, we have to engage in that so that the reconstruction at the macro level can take place. Handling of anger on the macro level without dealing with it on the micro level is just social manipulation. And what we don't want is to have that kind of manipulative process of anger define what we are as a body, as a church. We have to continually focus on the personal transformation that we are called to as a result of our spiritual tradition. Collective reconstructions will have no effect if they are neutralized by individual spiritual resistance. It will ring hollow. And yet the collective, social, societal dimension must remain a focus of our Christian concern. But how do we focus on those larger macro issues unless we provide the grounding of the reconstruction in our personal, individual, micro transformation? That's what the purpose of this whole retreat was, at least from my point of view. How is it that we as individuals can wrestle with this issue of anger, noting the ambiguities, noting the positive effects of incensive power without falling prey to the negative repercussions of it? This is what we as a church, I think, are called to do, because we have individuals in the church, and yet we have a group that is a more than the sum of the individual parts. The world will take notice of this. They will also take notice if we just succumb to the societal wave that makes anger a way to get our way in the world. And if that happens, then we're just going to be written off as another political or social or subcultural movement, and we undercut our own authority. And so I have this modest proposal. Each of us, at various times, wonders what real effect we can have on our society. Perhaps one influence we can exert is this. First, to serve as personal exemplars. By the way, I don't know whether this is an apocryphal story or whether it's true, but someone told me this story a while back, that there was a group of Buddhist monks waiting to get on a plane somewhere in an airport. Is this a story you've all heard before? And the man who was there with him is an Orthodox Christian. And so he was very intrigued by these men. And so he began to talk to them, and they were talking to him. Two of them were American, I think two were foreign, but they were able to have a very profound and deep and substantial conversation. And they got on the plane and they're talking. And one of the monks asked this young man, who was an Orthodox Christian, he said this, "You know, we respect monasticism wherever we see it, and clergy wherever we see them. But I have a question for you, and don't be offended by it." He said, "May I ask it?" And the young man said, "Yes, go ahead. I'm not sure I'll be able to answer it, but you can ask it." He said, "Why are so many of the monks and priests that we've met so angry?" And the man said, "Well, I don't know, but he told me this story, and I don't know whether it circulated far and wide, but it alerted me to the point is when we make anger a distinguishing mark of who we are, rather than gentleness and reverence, with a strong commitment to the truth." Don't hear me saying we just go with the breeze. But if we make anger our brand, we undercut our authority. And I think that that's what we need to do in our evangelization. Make sure that we're not evangelizing with an eye to success by stoking the fires of anger in our society. All right? This, I think, is very important. Remember, to stand against evil, all you need to do is provide the alternative of good. And that's what we need to do. First, to serve as personal exemplars, manifesting through our spiritual struggle how anger in our psychotherapeutic tradition of orthodoxy can be conquered either through elimination or mitigation. And second, to present the church as a microcosm of a society in which anger's hegemony has been broken, a real alternative to what I called at the beginning that day of anger, that place of anger, orthogotopia. This is not an easy personal or communal challenge, but definitely one worth considering. The disease is everywhere to be seen, but the cure is still quite elusive. And I think we can be part of that cure. One of the things that attracts people to that Buddhist monastery in Carlisle is they see individuals whose lives have been transformed by overcoming some of the captivity that they feel subject to in the world, the captivity of anger. There's no reason we can't provide that same kind of witness. There's no reason that only Buddhists can provide it. And I'm not saying anything negative about Buddhists there, but we have a tradition that can provide a witness that is even more powerful and more directed to the lives of these people. Unless we capitulate to the dynamic of anger that is all around us. So I wanted to end these presentations by referring back to what we already said. My focus of attention has been on the personal transformation of individuals who need to overcome the captivity to anger. But I want to end with this. It doesn't just have an effect on us personally. It has an effect on everyone around us, on the church as a whole, on the society as a whole, and on the world as a whole. The ripple effect starts with us individually, but it spreads out. And the antidote to the overwhelming and disconcerting and troubling and sometimes destructive and often violent faces of anger in our culture, do we have an antidote and an alternative to that? If we do, let's show it. Because I think this is what can make a larger difference. We have such power in our tradition, and that power comes from our humility and acceptance of that transforming power that comes with the Holy Spirit. This is why I wanted to end with this. Keep an eye out, by the way, in good publications, you know, newspapers you respect, magazines and journals you respect, and see how often anger comes up. It's amazing. Someone asked me the other day, isn't it a generational thing about anger? And I said, yes, it is. And you know what? People like who are old farts like me, I think we had anger in our life, but I think my students have a lot more in it in their lives right now. They're surrounded by it everywhere. And so it's up to us to provide the alternative. I'm an alternativist. I believe that orthodoxy has to have an answer that provides an alternative to the death-dealing and death-destroying movements out there, of which anger is one of the most prominent. All right? I think this is an important thing to leave with, this idea that we're not just transforming ourselves for our own salvation, but transforming ourselves for the healing of a culture all around us. And that we can do.